Thank you, Paul, and thank you, everybody, for dialing in for getting another commodities call. This one we're holding here in response to the negative prices we saw in WTI. We're very pleased to have with us Jeff Currie, Jane Corbillon, and Brian Singer out of research, as well as Anthony Dole off of our trading desk. And they're going to discuss what we're seeing and where we're going from here for the media and is off the record. Also want to let you know that if you want to ask a question, you can answer one. You can ask one over the webcast. We're trying to do this as efficiently as possible and as quickly as possible, as we know everybody's got to get back to their trading desks. Let me kick it off to Jeff Currie. Walk us through it.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning. I thought for the structure of today's call, you know, I'll give some background around yesterday's events and take it down to a really basic level. I apologize for those of you that are more experts in commodities, but there's a lot of people on this call that need some of the basics. Then I'll turn it over to Damian to talk about, you know, the outlook going forward, and, you know, also talk a little bit about some of the positioning dynamics, which were stretched going into this. And then Brian Singer will talk about the actual shut-ins that we're expected to see. And then finally, Anthony Dole will talk about the trading aspects of it from yesterday. So turning to the background of this, and I think it's really important to distinguish the fundamental story from the positioning story. So let's start with the fundamental story, and it's pretty basic. And this was a fairly well-telegraphed event. You know, a lot of people out there talked about the probabilities of crude oil going negative at Cushing. It went negative in Wyoming. So fundamentally, the story was pretty straightforward. You know, the idea is you had, you know, the severe demand losses. You had a lot of oil pushing through the global distribution system. It overwhelmed the capacity to transport it, to store it. And particularly in local places, like in this case, the mid-continent of the U.S. So the idea of oil prices going negative is really generated from the following observation, that a producer that is forced to shut in will be willing to pay somebody to take that oil to avoid shutting in. They'll do everything they possibly can to avoid that shut-in. And as a result, that's why you see negative prices. And they're usually negative to the level that it's required to get the transportation to find an alternative source. By the way, it's more difficult to happen at the Cushing hub than it is at a pricing point like Midland. But, you know, but to give you an idea how out of whack yesterday was, you know, I like to joke that, hey, minus $36 a barrel, you can use helicopters to airlift that oil out there. It was not a fundamental story. It was much more of a positioning story. So let's talk about the positioning. And the place where I want to begin is how these ETFs work, because the core of the problem here were ETFs that were long going into 2 days before expiration. Now, when we think about the oil ETF, it is not physical oil. It is paper oil. The GLD, the gold ETF, is physical gold. Simply the reason is you can pile a lot of, you know, all of that gold into your living room. In contrast, the U.S. oil, which just actually shut down before this call, we require 55 VLCs to store that oil. Now imagine 55 VLCs parked out on the East River. Can't happen. So it stays in paper. Now, what happens if it stays in paper? What distinguishes a oil futures from any other type of asset out there like equities or bonds is that you cannot buy and hold the position. You're going to be forced to roll. So essentially what they would do is they would buy May contract back in March, and as we come to expiration, near expiration in April, they sell that position in the May and then turn around and buy the June contract. So they just continue to roll, you know, front to back over that time period. Now, because this was a well-telegraphed event, we experienced this in 2009, where the front end would collapse on expiration when you had full storage from the U.S. oil ETF, because they'd be forced to sell in a very weak fundamental market without a lot of liquidity. The front end would collapse, they'd turn around, and they'd buy the back. Because we'd experienced that, well-seasoned ETFs made it very clear that they try to roll in advance. Now, there were some ETFs, that were positioned in places like China that were automated and do not really understand these dynamics, and they went into expiration very long. By the way, like the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index and all these other types of paper instruments, they roll, a week or 2 weeks ago to avoid the illiquidity you get on the front end. Now, you might have to ask yourself, why would they structure an ETF that would roll one day before the expiration? The only explanation I can come to is that they were watching the backwardation in the curve over the last several years and found value in doing that. Obviously, it's a lot of risk going up there. But I think the key point, and Damien will go over some of the fundamentals, just how long this market was going in there, is you had dried up liquidity going into expiration. You have no place to put the oil. And so instead of the negative price of the fundamental story, pricing a producer willing to take this oil away, what we had to price was the willingness of someone to take these ETFs out of those long positions, which is why we printed as low as minus $55 a barrel during that time period. By the way, we've seen this problem before. Mattel Gelshaft in the early 1990s was another example of this. These things are some of the biggest financial disasters we've seen. And I would assume this one's going to rank right up there, multi-billion dollar losses. But it's because of holding a position too close to expiration. So I think the key point here is this was an idiosyncratic event that occurred in Cushing due to the roll. Again, you can't buy and hold. You're forced to roll. They had a lot of length going into that expiration, and as a result, prices had to clear low enough to get somebody to take them out of it. This one last point is that the one thing I've noticed this morning is that while it was a very technical, idiosyncratic event isolated to Cushing, Oklahoma, the press coverage of it really has created a sentiment shift. All commodities are off right now, all equity markets. Most of my calls this morning are around deflationary concerns. So I think the bigger impact of this is really what it's done to sentiment, because it's just a lack of understanding of what happened here. They're taking it on face value. So I think, you've been looking at the other commodity markets, all of them are down very sharply overall today. So that's going to conclude my comments. I'll turn it over to Damien.
Thanks, Jeff. So maybe let me walk quickly through the mechanics of the expiration and what happened yesterday. As Jeff mentioned, negative prices in commodities we've seen before, natural gas in particular, even oil, whether it was 2016, 2009, 99. Here really the key was that it was a financial holder of an expiring contract that was trying to get rid of it. So, that was really the dynamic playing out yesterday. The WTI CME contract is physically settled, so if you are long into the expiration, which will be today, during the month of May, you will have to take delivery of physical crude in Cushing. You have to accommodate and find the room for that crude, and because Cushing is already filling up nearly to saturation, the ability to actually find that room in Cushing for a May delivery will be extremely challenging. So kind of that's the setup. Now, in terms of positioning, when you look at the open interest of the May contract as of yesterday morning, at 108,000 contract, it's not that big, but it is 5.5 times standard deviation larger than what you witnessed over the previous 24 expiration. Right? So there is a lot of open interest still in that expiring contract. And so in the end, that would have effectively been 55 million barrels of crude to be delivered in Cushing if those positions were not reduced. Now, Cushing in 2 weeks' time will be likely completely full, and that's only another 10 million barrels from here. So you could see the issue heading into the expiration. And so this led to this forced selling by investors, most likely. When we look at a significant increase in long positions recently, if you look at some of the shares outstanding of those oil ETFs, they're an enormous increase in length. So clearly, there's a lot of retail investment. Now, as Jeff mentioned, most ETFs roll early. They don't want to be caught into the expiration. But that's not the case for all instruments. So that's really the core, right? A sticky long position that was too large for the ability to take delivery into Cushing, and that led to the price action. So if we look at, you know, as of this morning, open interest has shrunk a lot. It's actually now about 2 standard deviations smaller than typically you would see on the day of expiration. But again, you know, that's still 8 million barrels equivalent of oil to be delivered next month. So some of that needs to be unwound today as well. You know, I think what is core here is how does it impact prices for the June contract? Well, again, that mechanics of expiration won't play out again until May 19th. If you think of a lot of the ETFs, like the USO, they're rolling earlier in May, around the 5th to the 8th. But I think it may have created a sentiment shift in the oil market, as Jeff mentioned, because of the violence of the move. It illustrates that, again, there is no lower bound for commodity prices. And at the end of the day, although the magnitude of the move isn't symptomatic of today's issue, it is reflective of the fact that we haven't resolved the current imbalance, right? Demand slightly getting better, a tiny pace of improvement as lockdowns are being eased. But it remains, you know, 20 million barrels per day below the current level of supply. So, you know, higher demand, cuts from OPEC, all that help over time, but the storage is running out in the next few weeks. So the downward pressure on prices will likely persist through the next few weeks. And I want to emphasize, this will be a short-term rebalancing, right? We don't have 2 months to find out where we can put the oil. As yesterday's price action indicated, the issue is binding in the month of May, right? That's why no one wanted to take physical crude delivery in Cushing in May. So that really will force a violent rebalancing now from a producer perspective. We already have seen low prices, negative prices, physically, locally in the U.S. in isolated places. But I think now this will become either negative or very low prices, a binding constraint for the next few weeks. Now, when you look across asset classes, to some extent, you've seen an initial resilience to lower prices because this, again, was a very short-term local issue. I think, you know, when we think about other asset classes, they typically reflect the back end of the curve where oil is more stable, more effective of marginal cost. But again, as you're trying to deal with this imbalance, with now the realization that prices can be sharply negative, even those long-dated prices in the next few weeks could see a significant repricing lower. So I think even though this is a transient issue, you know, not all asset classes will be able to look through what it implies for energy prices over the next couple months. That's really the core of what played out yesterday. And again, I really want to emphasize, as Jeff mentioned, you know, when you buy equities, you're owning a piece of a company. When you buy a commodity future, you're one side of a two-way contract that has a seller on the other end, right? And at the end, on expiration, those two get matched for delivery. And that's the issue the oil market faces today. There is no room to accommodate that delivery process. With that, Jeff, turning it back to you.
Yeah, I just want to also add on that point is what made this one far more extreme was the fact that this ETF waited till one day before the expiration to roll. We've seen these events. By the way, they're some of the biggest financial crises in history. You know, Mattel Gelshoff being one. We saw them in 09. You know, these rolls end up being, you know, very, very dangerous. But this one was exceptionally poorly timed. Hey, Brian, why don't you talk about the shut-in?
Great. Thanks, Jeff, and good morning. I'm going to briefly speak to how U.S. producers are considering shut-ins and where these could come from. In determining whether to shut in, producers largely look at their cash costs, particularly variable costs, and take a view on the longevity of below cash cost prices, and then lastly, what the risks are in terms of well degradation in the future, and then meeting any lease commitments. We believe inland producers that sell into local markets are more at risk than those that can access coastal markets, though if the ships on the coast or coastal refineries can't take oil, then even producers with coastal access are at risk of shut-ins. In terms of what wells could be shut in, we looked at wells in the lower 48 onshore in the Permian Basin, Eagle Ford, Bakken, DJ Basin, and California that combined comprise 8 to 9 million barrels per day. Of these, 3 million barrels per day of U.S. oil production come from wells that produce less than 100 barrels per day. These wells, in general, we believe have higher unit cash operating costs and would be at greater risk of impairment once brought back online or considered being brought back online after a shut-in. Based on our screen of inland versus coastal exposure and exposure to low-rate wells, we believe Pioneer Natural Resources and Parsley screen relatively better positioned among our E&P coverage, while California Resources, Laredo, Chesapeake, and Continental, along with Cimarex, screen relatively poorly positioned. Continental and Cimarex have already announced partial shut-ins. We expect additional shut-in announcements in the coming weeks, particularly if there's weakness in June futures, as there is today. Now, so far, we've heard from producers regarding CapEx reductions. We're assuming almost 50% lower year-on-year for E&Ps and low 40% when weight averaging in the majors. We've also gotten announcements of dividend cuts. Now the focus as we go into earnings season will be on the negative impact to production from both the lower CapEx as the year progresses and from the production shut-ins. Broadly, we believe consensus estimates are overestimating fourth quarter oil production for the bulk of U.S. oil producers. We see Concho and WPX with the most limited year-on-year declines in production. We see Apache, Continental, Marathon, and Noble with the greatest year-on-year U.S. oil production declines within our coverage. As the shut-ins become more material, equity investors can focus more on the recovery, and we are seeing some signs of this in recent equities trading. There's a lot more on shut-ins and the implications from producer announcements on equities in our recent reports. And I will turn it. I'll turn it back to Chris to turn it over to Anthony.
Anthony Doyle, why don't you jump in from the trading standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously unprecedented times, and you know, certainly something that we never would have imagined the scale of yesterday's move would have been possible, but certainly something that we've been telegraphing for a while. That when you have these geographical constraints, there's two things that really start to take hold in the markets, and that is the logistical constraints of actually having a physical player stabilize prices, and then the supply and demand of the futures themselves, i.e. who are the holders of the longs, who are the holders of the shorts, and when do liquidation on both sides need to occur. So now if we move on from yesterday's price action, as I think it's been pretty well covered by Jeff and Damian already, you know, some of the things that we're focused on, you know, on a going forward basis is what are the risks to this happening again in June contracts? You know, I think one of the things that we're going to be looking at very closely is the trajectory of Cushing inventories and whether this extreme price action and this extreme distress within the domestic Cushing market is going to force some pipes to re-divert some of the oil away from Cushing and therefore avoid the tank tops, which has really been the fear in the market that's created this this negative price action in WTI. And then the other thing that we're going to be looking at is how open interest evolves in the next several weeks. Does de-risking and does sort of a reduction in overall positioning start to happen across all of the different market participants? Does the extreme volatility that we've witnessed actually force a lot of the risk capital that's out there to reduce? The other thing that we're going to be very focused on is the impact in the other oil markets. So what impact is this starting to have on Brent? What impact is this starting to have for a lot of the oil producers within OPEC that have set a lot of their pricing differentials, the way that they sell oil to their refiner clients, which is use the global benchmark, i.e. Brent or one of the Middle Eastern crudes, and apply a premium or a discount. In this case, we're seeing very heavy discounts to those crudes. That could result in some negative pricing for some of the OPEC producers as well. So we're going to be very focused on that and seeing, you know, any reaction that comes in. You know, so far, my colleagues in research have certainly outlined what is necessary, and we certainly need to see shut-ins of U.S. production and shut-ins on a global basis that are linked to these extreme weak prices, and that really is the only way to solve the extreme imbalance that we're currently experiencing at the moment with this substantial demand loss. So I'd say those are sort of the, you know, the various things that we're focused on the trading side. Obviously, the markets have become a lot more volatile and a lot less liquid, and you know, certainly the ability to transfer risk in these markets has become a lot harder as a result. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Let's turn to the questions. Jeff, you want me to get in the questions? I can jump through. We've got tons of them coming in off the webcast. And I think the first primary question that's coming in is around Brent. If this can happen to WTI, why can't it happen to Brent? We've got 20 ships coming over from Saudi. They're going to about to hit the Gulf Coast. When that happens, does this all just sort of seep out into the seaborne market? What are we thinking there?
Well, I think the key issue with Brent is that, you know, it's a waterborne crude. You know, it's not going to have the same type of congestion that WTI will. WTI prices 500 miles from the water. Brent prices 500 meters from the water. You know, as somebody was jokingly saying, there's cruise lines you could fill up with oil. I think the key point there, you're not going to get so congested at Brent where you would have the need for producers to pay somebody to take the oil away because you can take it away. The other thing about Brent, it's a cash-settled contract as opposed to a physically settled contract, which it makes these dynamics on the roll far less, you know, potentially, you know, violent moves like that we've seen. Again, we've seen these before in WTI. This is not new. But I think Brent, you know, it's going to struggle. You know, it'll benefit because of its location being cash settled. It's unlikely to see the same type of dynamics. Now, there's other markers all over Europe where you can see these types of problems begin to develop. But something that's sitting 500 meters from the water, yeah, it can go down and visit the tens, but it's unlikely to go into an extreme negative level unless you completely run out of every potential ship to begin to utilize. Damien, why don't you talk about what's going on more of the grades around the world?
I mean, sure, I think, you know, Jeff's point was key. It's, you know, the issue is inland. So the further inland you go, the bigger the issue you have. It's, first of all, symptomatic yesterday that it's TI that sold off the most, emphasizing that it was a financial issue. But nonetheless, those physical crude grades in North America are starting to sell off. You have negative prices in West Texas, in Wyoming. And, you know, the countries there that are most exposed are large inland producers. So, of course, Canada and the U.S., why Brian's focus on the shut-ins. But that also applies to Russia, for example, to Colombia, to Ecuador. So that's probably where, you know, I think the shut-ins will occur. They have lasting consequences. That's something to not forget. It's hard to restart when you've shut in. So, you know, although you have to shut in now, it probably curtails the ability for the market to get that supply back later on. Something we'll have to deal with in the second half of this year.
All right. Next set of questions is around the June contract. Should we expect this to happen very soon to the June contract, or does the June contract have some time before it happens to it?
Well, I think the one thing with the June contract, it's getting hit hard right now with the U.S. oil shutting down, probably indicative that they tried to roll early so nobody could front-run them. You know, and so, you know, I tend to think, you know, you rarely ever see the same type of positioning mishaps are reoccurring because people change their behavior. But the fundamental story of negative prices, that can absolutely play out again. But the positioning story, you know, I would view it as being, you know, we don't know what's happened to the U.S. oil fund right now as we talk, but I would tend to think the positioning will be very different. You know, one point that Anthony likes to make is this happened over and over in 2009, where that front end kept collapsing for like 3 or 4 months straight until finally the market rebounded. So the odds of that happening again, but from a fundamental perspective, as we go into June expiration, is quite high.
I think the one thing I would say is that we have more time here, right? So there are corrective mechanisms that can happen for Cushing on a, you know, on a physical basis. There are pipe flows that can be diverted. There's refinery runs that can tweak that can enable the avoidance of these tank tops. But certainly, you know, these are measures that are necessary right now, and certainly something that we need to start seeing in the data very quickly to start getting the comfort that you know, that this isn't about to happen to the June contract.
Last question around the contracts is, can a holder of a futures contract simply refuse delivery? We've gotten that from several people, or is that something you're just not allowed to do?
Anthony?
I mean, you would structurally default, so you'd have to pay for all the costs associated with it, so you know, the costs there are significant too. So it's not an easy option that gets you out of trying to get out of that position.
Yeah, I my line actually went dead as you were reading the question, but I think it was sort of around someone's ability to not fulfill their obligations on the exchange. I mean, as Damien points out, I think there would certainly be a very significant challenge to that would occur, and obviously all costs associated with you know, whoever's on the other side and waiting for delivery would obviously claim a lot of those costs.
Another set of questions around policy and OPEC. Is there anything that OPEC Plus or policymakers can do in response that could rectify this situation near term?
Well, so we got a few comments yesterday from the U.S. administration. Talks about, you know, buying into the SPR. Effectively, that's already embedded in our balances. It impacts the Gulf Coast if you can get it in. And again, does nothing really for the Cushing delivery point. You know, it's been talking about tariffs on imports. You know, again, you know, the margin, it helps a little bit because it prevents more crude coming in. But again, that would be on the Gulf Coast. Doesn't tackle the localized storage saturation that we have. What you'd need is you'd need an enormous cut right now. You know, it took 4 days to agree to a cut that starts in another 2 weeks. Even if tomorrow we had another incremental cut, you know, it's a 40-day shipping time to most destinations from the Middle East. It does not resolve the local saturation. All those policy prospects are just too late. You know, you could start to potentially, we'll see what the Texas Railroad Commission discusses and decides, you know, prorate per production. But again, even that, if it takes 3 weeks, it's too late already. So this is crunch time from a physical market perspective. You know, policy decisions are probably too late at this point.
A corollary of that question is around demand and supply and how long this lasts. What does demand have to get back to in order to stabilize this market? And is there really enough supply that can get shut down to get this market balanced? We were talking about, you know, we're oversupplied by as much as 30 million barrels a day. How does that work? How long does that take?
Sure. So, you know, the balance that we laid out for the month of May required at that point that, you know, call it 5 million barrels per day of supply be shut in due to prices. You know, that's important because we're going to get some production cuts due to policy. We still have a little bit of room to store, right? We're not full everywhere. We're hitting issues in May locally. But again, we need, call it that 5 million barrels per day of price-induced shut-in by May. You know, it's unprecedented. It's an enormous number. But, you know, it will have to be achieved, hence the violence of this rebalancing. And again, it's not a June-July story. It has to occur then. Now, that's core because by May, demand won't have recovered significantly, right? We estimate April demand is probably down 25 million barrels per day from the impact of the virus. By May, that's probably down maybe 19, 20 million barrels per day, so you see a modest improvement. At that point, though, you know, the hard work has been done by the supply side. So as demand gets a bit better in June and July, since you've shut supply to meet demand because there is no storage, actually the market's already in deficit by then, right? So I think, again, the core of the issue is lack of storage. The short-term adjustment can only be on the supply side through shut-in. Demand has nowhere the ability to solve that. But once you have achieved a shut-in to balance this market, any incremental improvement in demand does create a deficit. It's not a huge recovery in prices, but it is a sign that you're creating finally some relief on storage, and that probably is the first stage of the rebalancing.
Questions around the refiners. How do the refineries respond in this environment, and are they vulnerable? Could they actually benefit?
So the way we've mapped the refinery outlook really is, you know, the issue they face is the one we just discussed, which is a demand collapse. So, you know, they have limited ability to run. Their storage is getting full. You have the same issues there. It's even actually more binding because you can't mix diesel, gasoline, and jet. You have to keep them segregated. So you're hitting those constraints even faster than you would on the crude side. So as that saturation takes place, refiners run less. That's a problem for the crude market, right? That suddenly your outlet through the refining system is over. So if you're a producer of two pipes, one to a refinery, one to a storage tank, well, one of those two now can't function, exacerbating the crude localized stress. As demand recovers, you know, refiners will want to restart. It takes time, though, right? So, you know, it takes 2 to 4 weeks if you've stalled your refinery. So initially, you're going to draw products. You have plenty of storage. There's no shortage looming. You know, margins will recover as that draws. But as soon as refiners come back online, you know, demand hasn't normalized, and so margins can't stay good, right? So, you know, you can get, like we saw in China, a short-term boost in margin once demand starts to pick up. But because the demand recovery will be quite gradual, in the end, you know, margins can't be good for any sustained period of time. Because, you know, refiners can just ramp up activity and produce what's necessary. So that's kind of the core on the refining side. Sure, conceptually, they benefit from this super cheap crude, but because of the demand shock, they can't actually run. So, you know, it means a limited ability to monetize the very, very extremely cheap crude that you can see locally, even in North America.
Several questions around nat gas. That's holding up relatively well. Is that trade getting crowded? Should it be holding up well? Just explain why it is.
Sure. So I think, you know, natural gas did have a big bounce yesterday because I think it became apparently clear that we're going to be losing a lot of associated gas production. You know, that's been core to our bullish thesis on natural gas. You know, for our winter forecast, we're well above forward and consensus because, yes, there is a demand hit from losing the industrial demand due to the virus. But when you're looking at shut-ins of production of, call it, you know, 1.5 to 2 million barrels per day just in the U.S. Of associated gas, and that over a six-month period, then that will far outweigh the losses on the demand side. So, you know, this is ultimately a bullish gas setup. One thing to keep in mind, though, right, in the short term, the gas market is still oversupplied, right? The shortage really accrues over time, really is problematic by the winter. If gas rallies too much today, you're going to hit that October storage constraint for the 2020 balances in the U.S. So, you know, it can't rally too much now because you still have this binding storage constraint. You're not nowhere near as close to storage capacity as you are in oil. But again, you know, if you rally too much too soon, you won't get to that constraint. So, you know, you can't move too much, but by the winter, once you're through that storage constraint, the balance does look quite healthy. And so we reiterate our bullish view for the winter as well as for 2021. Our forecast for the winter is 350 for NYMEX gas prices. And the summer 2021 is 325, still well above the forwards.
And Chris, I might just add to that in terms of the impact of the shut-ins on gas. When we looked at the Permian Basin, Eagle Ford, Bakken, and DJ Basin, and we looked within those basins at oil wells that are producing less than 100 barrels a day, that represented about 1.5 million barrels a day of oil production, but it also represents 4 to 5 BCF a day of estimated associated dry gas production. So to Damien's point, if there are oil shut-ins, those will come with gas, with associated gas shut-ins as well.
Mr. Singer, that's a good segue to the other question, which is how easy is it to get these shale fields off and on, especially those smaller fields, 100 barrels per day fields? When they turn off, will they ever turn back on? And what does that say about long-term production in the U.S.?
Yeah, thanks. So the producer comments on this are mixed. A lot of the producers have highlighted that they shut in wells all the time. I think that's particularly in reference to some of the higher rate flush horizontal wells. If there's fracking or drilling activity that's going on nearby, then oftentimes producing wells nearby will be shut in temporarily. Those shut-ins typically are days to weeks, not necessarily months. And the producer comments suggest those wells can be brought on relatively quickly, and I think that's under the context of a shut-in that lasts days or weeks. We think that there is greater risk when we talk about some of these vertical legacy wells not coming back on or coming on at reduced rates if they are shut in for a prolonged period of time, particularly if there's ever any issues regarding wells that need repair or need some additional CapEx. Those may take longer to come back online, or the producers may decide not to bring them back online. So that's why we're focused a little bit more on some of these sub-100 barrel a day type wells, not only because they have higher unit operating costs, but because we do think there is some greater risk that a percentage of those wells, and it's hard to quantify the precise percentage, will be impaired down the road.
And Damian, a similar question around Russia. Will they have the ability to turn stuff on and off there in their field?
Yeah, I mean, that's a risk, right? You have a lot of pretty much all conventional production in Russia. Some of it has by the ability to shut in and restart, but you know, some of it will be probably challenged in restarting, potentially lost, given the geology of the Russian field. So I think, you know, that might be a sticky loss of capacity. And again, broadly, when you look at, you know, it's pretty much any legacy reservoir that will have that issue. And so that's why it's important to think about, you know, what it means longer term. You know, the bullish story on oil will be both the demand recovery, but also the persistence of lost capacity due to shut-ins. So I think that can set, you know, not in the short run, but, you know, by 21, a much, you know, stronger recovery in prices than if it was simply a demand shock here.
All right, that's a good segue into the last set of questions I want to ask here, because we are coming up against the 45-minute mark here. But people will obviously have expressed a lot of interest in how we would recommend they trade this environment. Recognizing that it's very difficult to trade the immediate environment right now, but if you think about, if you have a view that we will come out of the corona crisis at some point, and the demand side at least will start to stabilize and normalize, how would you position in that to try to capitalize on that environment? Damian, why don't you kick it off?
Sure. So let's just look at, you know, even what we've seen the last 2 days, right? It's a collapse in the short-term price relative to the long-term price because it is this short-term issue. What we expect from the recovery is a reversal of that. Of course, you know, initially, simply because you're not running out of storage. But if you think about the recovery in prices, we expect to see more producer hedging, right? What they're living through now will probably create a greater incentive to hedge, so long-dated prices will be capped. And as the physical market draws on those inventories, the spot price will gradually increase. You know, we have a pretty good template for this, which is 98.99. In a matter of 2 years, we had both an OPEC market share battle. We had a demand shock from the Asian crisis. And although, you know, it wasn't as dramatic as now, you know, the sell-off pretty much took the same path with a big contango collapse in front-end prices. And within the year that followed, the trough in February 99, you had that big rotation in the forward curve. Long-dated prices didn't rise that much initially, but the spot pivoted. You know, think of what we just discussed on the supply side. If I have sticky production losses, I'm going to be relying more on inventories to balance the market. As those inventories draw, there will be conceptually a scarcity premium in the front. So that's really the core of our forecast on the recovery. It's a curve trade, right? It's the spot price outperforming the long-dated price. When you look at 99, it actually was a much better short ratio trade than actually being long the front, because it's a lot less subject to that near-term price volatility. So that would be really the core. Eventually, though, you know, if we truly have a binding supply issue where, you know, OPEC spare capacity is insufficient because we've shut in so much that can come back online, And sure, long-dated prices will recover, but that's, call it stage two of the recovery. The first one is the curve rotation.
Anthony, if you can jump in, long-term, near-term, what are you advising clients do here, hedgers, producers, investors in the oil complex?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, listen, on the near term, you know, I think the advice that we certainly are giving and something that we've been telegraphing on these calls for a few weeks is anything can happen in these markets given the sort of, you know, the corrective mechanisms that we mentioned before, i.e. the ability of physical players to step in to stop price dislocations has disappeared. So I think, you know, on the front end, you know, there's, as we saw yesterday, there is no bound to where things can go. And when it becomes a question of supply and demand of futures, it really is where is that incremental buyer versus seller of a specific contract. I'd say sort of on the, you know, on the long end, we're certainly going to be extremely focused on the pace of demand pickup from some of the European countries and other countries around the world that are starting to ease some of the measures. We've started to observe a pickup in power demand in Western Europe. We're seeing through our industrials and metals business a willingness from producers there to have factories restart. And so, you know, I think one of the things that we're going to be very focused on is, you know, obviously, you know, our colleagues in research have come up with a framework for, you know, how demand recovers. I think, you know, as we start getting more and more data, really getting a framework for how the demand recovery looks and how quickly we start to see that diesel demand, gasoline demand, jet fuel demand come back to the market, because combined with the damage that we're going to be doing to the physical infrastructure by forcing shut-ins in the U.S., that's going to set up a very attractive trade, in our view, on the long side, in the second half of the year, as the market still you know, is faced with a reduction in OPEC supply and a declining inventory environment.
And finally, Brian Singer, how would you position? What's your favorite trade here in the U.S. oil producers' equity?
Yeah, thanks. For a recovery, Pioneer, EOG, and Concho are stocks that have strong balance sheets. Concho, we've highlighted here in the near term, has the most limited late year oil production declines due to their favorable hedges. But all three stocks, we think, with their strong balance sheets, are well positioned. For those looking outside shale, we've highlighted Hess for longer term growth in Guyana that we believe is very well positioned on the cost curve. Among those less well positioned, we've highlighted Continental, where we expect 20% plus oil declines year on year when looking out into the fourth quarter, and much greater impact to these low prices here today.
All right, terrific. We're right up again in the 45-minute hour. Thank you, guys, for everybody for dialing in. This will be available via replay for those people who had trouble getting in on time. You will be able to hear the beginning of it very soon. We'll get it up on our GS portals. We thank you again for dialing into another Goldman Sachs Commodities Call.